Do you remember when you learned that song? Most of us can't. We seem to have known it always. And it's an odd song. Think too hard about the words, and every verse is just another layer of problem. But settle into the words and the melody, and whole worlds of meaning open up. Played on bagpipes, it belongs to funerals, where sadness is born with dignity and honor. It's an AA song, witness to the struggle and the miracle of turning a life around. Maybe you hear the echoes of Judy Collins or Sam Cooke or Joan Baez when you sing it. And then it's the 60s. Amazing Grace can move your heart even if it makes your mind want to run in the other direction. I know some say that this power isn't in the words, but in the shared memories that we all bring to every hearing, that the song isn't even religious anymore. Or if it is about faith, it's a faith larger than any denomination. A faith of people who overcome obstacles, of people who dream of a better tomorrow, not a faith of Methodists or Presbyterians or Episcopalians. But the words do matter. And they are a part of that song's power. And that raises some questions that deserve a fair hearing. Questions about wretchedness and grace, and what in the end saves any of us at all. What does, what can, what might make our brokenness more whole? Stay with me this morning as we think together about these things. I promise I will do my best not to give anyone a case of spiritual hives. In fact, thinking together about grace might even help. So let's start with that word. Now, Wikipedia says, it is the love and mercy given to us by God because God desires us to have it, and not because of anything we have ever done to earn it. It's understood by Christians to be a spontaneous gift from God to man, generous, free, and totally unexpected and undeserved. It takes the form of divine favor, love, and clemency. And for once, I can tell you, Wikipedia got it precisely right. For within Christianity, grace is so important, it is one of the concepts that has divided folks into what became warring camps. It was questions about grace that made Luther nail those 95 theses to the church door, and it still divides Catholic from Protestant. You see, the Roman Church believes that grace comes most powerfully through the sacraments, which have efficacy even if no one is there but the priest. Protestants of every stripe hold that it is a gift from God based on the faith of the believer. Different answers to where and how the gift can be found help explain the different varieties that Protestants have become. This notion of grace divided the Universalists from the Calvinists. I mean, Calvinists emphasized the utter helplessness of human beings. But the Universalists knew a God so loving that forgiveness was always available, always abundant, larger, stronger, more sure than even a lifetime of sin. For them, our ancestors, grace and free will worked together collaboratively to bring all to salvation. Those early universalists were so sure of the possibility of God's grace, the only thing that was left to talk about was human choice. There was no doubt. But this idea still divides theological liberals from theological conservatives to this day. As you can hear in the words of an evangelical theologian, Charles Wright, who says, liberals give an exaggerated place to the abilities of man to decide his own fate and to effect his own salvation. My point here is that where you stand on the idea of grace marks what spiritual universe you live in. It says as much about the deep questions you bring to life as it does about the answers you find. Unitarian Universalism grew out of Christianity. 75 years ago, we were very comfortable being known as the most liberal of Christians. And even to this day, we still have one foot in the Christian communion and one foot out. And both the tensions and the excitement within our tradition come, I think, because we really are doing the hokey pokey. We're just all doing a different step. We've been preaching salvation by character for centuries now. Grace, goodness, forgiveness, blessing are there, are not at all in doubt. And because that is true, our individual choices matter. This is a faith that says all you have to do, all that is required, is to take one more step right now toward the good you know. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to run the whole race. You just have to step towards the best with your head and your heart and your hands and trust that the good will be there to meet you. Optimism like this may in fact be encoded in our DNA, but the truth is, it doesn't make us immune to wretchedness. That we know in our personal lives. We see it in the faces, the stories, the dark times of our friends. We carry it whenever we watch someone we love keep on in patterns that we know one day could destroy their lives. Oh, we may not talk about it much, but not because we've solved this problem of living, but because we know how devastating the judgment of others can be. You see, to be called a wretch by anyone else is an attack of a deep sort. It shuts us down and closes off the connection and the hope we need. But come to it yourself. Hit bottom and know it. And then the miracle starts. And that is how it feels. I once was lost, and now I'm found. Was blind, and now I see. That big a change, that big a turnaround doesn't come through effort alone. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Tis grace that brought me safe thus far, and grace that will lead me home. You see, I don't think the biblical God is needed for this truth to stand. I think most of us can read it in our own experience. In human life, there really are times that luck or fate intervene in a way so deep and compelling that we are catapulted from desperation to gratitude. It's like there's some kind of lightning bolt that burns through the old and leaves an empty space. But when gratitude takes root and begins to grow, in that emptiness, it feels like a gift. And it changes everything. We may not use that word grace a lot, and there are good reasons for that. But make no mistake, we very modern, very liberal souls believe in and depend on grace. There really are times when we all need saving. And there are times when each of us, every one of us, has been saved. We treasure those moments, celebrate those moments no less than John Newton cherished the hour that he first believed. Newton wrote that hymn because of his own sense of conversion. And he had kind of an 18th century worldview for sure, but he was amazingly like you and me. And this becomes really clear when you contrast the myth behind this song and the truth of the man's life. Now that myth has been around for a long, long time, almost since Amazing Grace was printed. And it keeps getting reinvented and relearned every couple of generations. Arlo Guthrie was the one who helped transmit it to us. And many of us have kept it going since. Here's what Guthrie wrote. It was in 1965 that I started telling the story of John Newton. And the story is basically that he was at sea with a ship full of people chained to each other. And something happened, a storm or something. And he promised God that if he was allowed to live, he would turn his life around. And he did. He took the people home, sailed back to England, and started writing songs. That's an abbreviated version. I think it goes something like that. That myth isn't abbreviated, it's telescoped. Newton did go to sea when he was 11 years old. He was a rowdy, insolent, troublesome sailor. He got traded from one ship to the other and was flogged or put in the chains more than once. I pretended to talk of virtue, he wrote, yet my delight in habitual practice was wickedness. He called himself a blasphemer, said he had renounced Christianity, and made a great point of arguing anyone he could find out of their faith as well. He did sail through a storm in his 20s. The ship was almost lost, but he wasn't the captain then, and it wasn't a slave ship at all. This brush with death did convert him back to the Christianity of his childhood. And when he landed in London, through the help of a friend, he did become the captain of a slave ship. He never took any of his cargo home. In fact, he was sought after as a captain because on his ships there were no revolts, and he kept the deaths of his human cargo to a minimum, keeping the profits up for his investors. As he prepared for his fourth journey to Africa, his health failed. He never sailed again. His religious quest did finally lead him to be ordained in the Church of England in 1764. And there he started writing songs. Back in those days, the only thing you could sing in worship were the Psalms, and there were only three chants that went with them. But Newton wanted something more. And at prayer meetings and revivals, he wrote songs for people to sing. Amazing Grace was written in 1772, and the slave trade had nothing to do with it. He was an evangelical, concerned about bringing people back to the church he knew. In fact, it wasn't until 1788, 34 years after he retired from slaving, that Newton became an abolitionist. It was then that he joined forces with Wilberforce and did help England turn itself around. The life story of Captain John Newton is the story of the regeneration of a very dramatic, bad boy. It was a series of narrow escapes from death, many of which he helped bring on himself, followed by a hunger and a surge for something better, which was, of course, followed by a return to his old, familiar, less successful habits. The man took two steps forward and one step back most of his adult life. If this was a conversion experience, it was a conversion that took his whole life long. I find that story offers a much more realistic hope than the myth ever did. You see, it's not incongruous to be a theological liberal and be looking for grace. It doesn't mean that you are a sinner in the hands of an angry God. It really means that honesty has taken the place of arrogance. And some measure of maturity has led you to see that not everything that comes to you is your own accomplishment. To be looking for grace is to cultivate an openness, a tender longing, a trust in luck or fate or whatever we would call the good that is larger than ourselves. And it is the practice of gratitude that grows so deep and strong, it changes everything. Call it the grace of God. Or as Wendell Berry does, call it the grace of wild things. It doesn't really matter very much. As long as we remember every now and again that it really is there waiting, it will be there your whole life long. And our choices about it matter.